He was going to go back to New York and play in the stock market as it was in those days with the big boys. Well, they were just waiting for him, and he didn't last long, about 3 months, I guess. And he was on the way back west. And his uncle at that time was a well-known practicing lawyer in San Francisco, and he talked him to coming out there. And he so-called read law for about a winter. That wasn't for him again. Back to Virginia City he went. And then from there, somehow he wandered up into the Northwest here. And again, he got into a promotion. They were going to build a railroad out to Port Angeles. They're going to build it in the tidelands, and then by doing that, they didn't have to grade anything. Just drive a lot of pilings of those big trees and run the train around. Well, after they got it about a mile of it, the government caught up with them and said, "What are you doing driving pilings in Indian land? Out." So back he went to Seattle and decided he was going to prospect. And of course, the prospect had to have some money. He worked at various jobs, anything he could get. He'd talked to some of the engineers for the surveyors for the Great Northern Railroad who had come through this valley and looking for a way to bring the railroad over the hills, over the mountains, over the Cascade Mountains. They told him about seeing many signs of mineral, as you folks who have gone up and down the valley further see it on all sides of you. The red stains, of course, all mean mostly iron pyrites, but there's mineral. And so he prospected around, and he thought, well, there's nothing up there. And as I remember it or know it, then he went up into Methow, the next valley over and on the Okanagan country the next year, and prospected nothing. And it always stuck in his mind to come back here. So he prospected all summer here. And the way he got up lake, he'd somehow gotten a boat, a rowboat, and he rowed it up the lake and stuck it in the bushes down in what's now Lucerne, and came up here on foot with a pack on his back, a rifle in one hand and a fishing pole in the other. And he prospected again all summer, and all he saw or found were these various outcroppings you see here, none of them which have the making, even to this day, of a mine. He knew enough about geology. He knew that he had to find mineral in what they call in place, or it wasn't worth finding. And he'd been up around the what's now Holden Lake and the Mary Green up in there, and it was getting late in the season, and he wanted to get some game, primarily deer, to get something to eat, and so he come down, walk down to Lucerne, and row back to what is now Chelan. And sitting on top of the hill up here, he'd come up around. As those have been up to Holden Lake will notice it's a big cirque, a big rounding place like that, and you come out on top of the edge of the hill here. It was evening, dusk, just before the sun went down. And looking down on this valley here, the sun was sloping. At that time, there wasn't as many green trees as here. They'd had a bad forest fire, and it had burned the limbs off so that they were just the bare trunk standing, and you could see through them to an extent. And as the sun sloped, as it set, he could trace and see with his eye what he thought was a ledge running down the mountain. So the next morning he got up and came on down, and again he looked around all day, 2 or 3 days here, and he said, "Oh, I'm wasting my time. I've got to get some food together and get down to the lake. I'm going to get caught in the winter here." And he shot a deer, and the deer ran into this wash that you see come down here. He's taken me many times to the spot. And there's a place where the water had come over maybe 5 or 6 feet of land like that, and had washed the rock clean and fresh. And the deer had fallen dead right there. And so it was kind of late in the day. So I thought, well, I'll strip this deer out tonight, hang it to dry, which of course, as you hunters know, you have to do. You don't eat it right away, or you get it clean and hang it up. The next morning, he took a look at where he was, and here was copper outcroppings, quite plain. And then he decided, I found this ledge that he could see from way up in the mountain. You see the sun. If you ever look down in a forest when the sun is high or low, it slants in through the trees much better, and you see the contour of the land and the makeup of it. And so that was the discovering of the holding low, the mine up here. So he thought, well, I'm not going to try to take the time to try to stake this out and find it out. It's too late in the year. I've got to get down that lake or I'm going to be frozen in. It was in September. And so down lake he went. And I think the next year he decided he didn't have enough money to come up here, so he worked another winter at what he could get. And the following year he came back up here. Now, the first year, I'm not positive of the dates because things are a little hazy in those records. I think it was 1893, that he saw the thing here. He came back in 95, 94 or 95, I do not know for sure. Anyway, then he really prospected carefully, and he located the drift of the lode, the direction in which it was going, and he decided to stake it out. So then, you know, those days, I guess they still do it. You chop your stakes and you drive them in the ground and you label them in the corners and everything, and he did that. And on his way, then he stayed around all summer developing the direction of the lode, the width and so forth, how far he wanted to go, and he located about 7 claims. And he went, that fall he went on down to Wenatchee and filed it. And he came back next year to see what he could do to start the claims. He'd gotten together enough money to buy some dynamite and tools and so forth. And this time he came back with pack horses. And also unwanted were about 50 other prospectors. They were all over the place here like bees, because in that day, these strikes were coming up, you know. That was about the time of the famous Yukon strike. And when everything like that got around, you didn't have to get it around to file him. Mere filing of 7 claims in one row, boom, that must be good. So here they were all looking around. All over the place. So that is where it started. And he worked it, and finally he thought he had enough to form a company, so he formed the Holden Gold and Copper Mining Company. And then the next problem was, of course, in forming the company, he sold the mine, what he'd found, to the company for a block of stock, which was the thing they did in those days. And do it today. And so that gave him, he could take and sell. He could sell his own stock for personal living purposes, and he could sell the treasury stock, so-called, for development. And in the early days, he put every last cent he could get out of the treasury sales into the mine. That kept it going. I can't remember the year. Seems to me it was around 1910, 11, 12, right in there someplace. The Inland Empire Railroad people, men connected with that, who were also connected with the tremendous silver stocks, our strikes just out of Spokane East in the Coeur d'Alene. And that year they put around $90,000 into cash development in the mine. And he was quite thrilled at that because they diamond drilled part of it. In other words, I don't know whether you know what diamond drilling is. Diamond drilling is a pipe with real diamonds put in the edge, and as it spins, it cuts through the rock, and then when they draw it out, they get a core, the inside part, that shows them exactly what they're traveling through. And they diamond drill this whole thing here pretty thoroughly. And then they knew they had a mine, and before that, they decided they kind of got the cart before the horse. They were going to get ready to smelt this, so they formed the Chelan Transportation and Smelting Company, and they sold stock in that, and they made a railroad grade from here to the top of the hill, and that is the foundation of the road that you travel on today up to the point where she starts the switchbacks. And right there they run into a tremendous engineering problem, how to get this railroad down to the lake at a grade that the old-time engines could handle. Of course, those days, the narrow-gauge railroads used very small drive wheels, and they had much more power than you realize. So they had made most of the cuts out down there. And then, about that time, copper slid and hit bottom. You couldn't give copper away. And that pretty much covers the early day of this. However, they had all those records, and you went on, you did what they called assessment work. They never patented the claims. Assessment work. Well, assessment work, when you have a mine or a claim, you do so much work each year figure out how much it cost, and you record it. And you can do the bottom claim, do all your work in the bottom claim and the counts in the upper. So we used to come up here and do that. Now, the other side of it, you have I think you folks are all enjoying such a lovely, beautiful place. And I know the Holden family is eternally grateful to the Lutheran people for carrying on the name of Holden, because my father, prospector and so forth, was still rather an idealistic man. And I'm sure that if he looks down on all of us here in this lovely surroundings, that he is as thrilled as I am. My life as a boy up in here, every year from the time I was about 10 years old up to 16, I decided Uncle Sam needed me for the war. Why, I used to come up here and spend all that time until time to go back in the fall. My mother didn't come up so early. She didn't like the early mosquitoes. There was lots of them in here. So I had a boyhood that I'll never forget up in here. I've spent as much as 3 weeks at a time, the only human being in this whole valley, my two dogs and a fishing rod and my gun. I keep mentioning the gun. Well, in those days, there were quite a few what we call silver tip in those days. As a grizzly bear, and the grizzly has the longer hairs. He has guard hairs, much like a silver fox, that were silvery on the outside, and we called them silver tips because the tip of the hair showed silver. Might tell of an incident that happened up here to Dad and I. Up here where Lyman Glacier is, you've probably all been up there and you've seen those meadows around the lower park. And I was 12 years old, I remember, and for my birthday that year, I'd been wanting a Savage rifle. I wanted a real gun. I'd had a 22 and that was a pop gun. So he gave me a 25-35 Savage. Any one of you that know rifles, that's a nice deer gun, but that's all it is. It shoots a long distance well, but deer or something like that's about all it will stop. And he told me, now, don't you ever fire into a bear with that, because we ran into him. Well, I saw this silver tip. He was eating in the low berries below the ice level where the snow was. Somebody noticed that Dad, standing about 20 from me, I was going to show him how good my gun was, and I raised him. I got one bullet in him. Well, the bear, all I did was make him a little bit unhappy, and he took one look at us and started across the meadow, and he wasn't walking. And my dad said right away, he said, look, hold your ground, whatever you do, don't run. So I did. And we stood there and fired and fired. Afterwards, after the bear, he slid to a stop, maybe 15, 20 feet in front. He just slid to a stop. He was all done. We put enough into it. We counted 7 bullet holes in him and took that much to stop him. There was one incident to it. I swore we were hitting him in the forehead, and we looked, and there was 3 or 4 gashes right up here in the forehead. And so that fall down at school, we had a professor, Van Voris, nice guy, but he was from the East, and I told us, what did you fellas do this summer? So we all came up with stories, and that was my story, and he practically called me a doggone liar in front of the class. And the Irish in me boiled up just a little bit. So I nursed that all winter. Next summer I came up and I crawled, went clear back up to Lyman, and I found the carcass of this bear with the skin had all rotted away, and I cut the head off, and there were the 3 grooves right in there. You can see them plain. Well, the grizzly bear, and most bears have, especially the grizzly, he has an ivory piece, shield, that lays right over his eyes. It's about 1/2 inch thick, and it's about 2.5-3 inches long. And that is the hardest ivory I've ever seen, because after I laid that thing on his desk, and he apologized, I took it home, and I took a hacksaw, and I tried to saw that ivory, you know, I could barely touch it. So that's a little anecdote about up here. Without preparation, one wonders what you talk about the early days up here. Of course, everything was brought in by pack horse. And they used to keep the horses down here by, in the summertime, down where they call Refrigerator Harbor, down there at Lucerne. And Lucerne, of course, then was known as Railroad Creek Bar. All these bars that go out to the lake, all these out where the soil goes out, you found it makes a beach or a little rounded place you call bars. And one time I asked her, where did they ever start calling these bars? Well, it seems that in the East, they call anything that is makes a bar in the water, a mound of sand or anything, a bar. So that's why they were called bars up and down the lake. And then a little later, a German lady by the name of Mrs. Shearer, who was a wonderful cook, started a little dining room and hotel there. And the water system was rather primitive. You had a long cable, a wire ran down into the lake, and you'd send the bucket down, zing, it would hit the water hard, and then you'd wind the crank and bring the water up for the whole hotel bucket at a time. That was the water system. But there was lots of berries in this area, and when I would know I was going down to pick up the mail or something, and berries were ripening, I would always try to pick up and carry a... Remember the old 5-pound lard pails we used to get? I'd try to pick at least a lard pail full of berries, and I'd go in, and for a return, I'd get a pie. She'd make up a pie for me, either huckleberry or that was my favorite. So she lasted there quite a few years, and then 1918, my father died, and I went to war to save the world for democracy, and when I came back, many things had changed. And a lot of people used to comment on the fact that my father, when he was out to work, he was in overalls and dirt like the rest, and when he dressed up, he always wore a derby hat and a Prince Albert coat and a Prince Albert tie and so forth. Well, that's the way they dressed in that days, but look back and looked at those early experiences on the stage and singing and the people he traveled with, that's the way they dressed. I mean, he wasn't trying to show off for anybody, because I know the miners up here, I've seen it happen several times. That Irish temple would get to go, and he'd get in an argument with one of the miners, and they'd get him in the argument just to see him do it. And off would come the derby hat, bang, it would go on the ground, and the coat would follow at the top. Now, come on, who wants to dispute that? Well, of course, then they'd all just break into gales of laughter, because they just did it to see him get upset. And I think one final anecdote that might give you an idea, it does to me, I've never forgotten it, as to the character of Dad. You don't need to be told from the way I'm talking that I was terribly fond of my father. I mean, to me, he was a little tin god. Not a little tin god, a big tin god. So he had about 25 or 30 miners working up here, and he'd agreed to work through that winter. And you people that winter here know they get pretty rough. There's lots of snow. And so he told them as an added descendant, he says, you're going to have turkey for Christmas. So Christmas was coming close, and he bought the turkeys downtown. I can still see my mother preparing the two turkeys, wrapping them so he could carry them on his back and wouldn't get damp and wouldn't spoil. He got up on the little old steamer, I think it was the Chichaca, I can't remember which one it was, to Lucerne, and nobody, no sir, it was snowing, and nobody was about to go in over that snow. He offered them, I guess, anything he could. They weren't going to go, no sir. So on to his back went the turkeys. And he didn't have a pair of snowshoes with him, but he borrowed a pair. The real, you've got some in the museum, I think, the real oblong snowshoes. I've come in with him over it. And Mr. Bergermark, of having used some of that kind and sinking in. So the way he got up here, he told me later, he tied thongs to the front of each snowshoe and then made a toggle in his hand so that he'd hold on at every step. It was so deep and so wet, he'd have to, you stop and think of coming up from Railroad Creek Bar from the lake, step at a time to here, and snow deep enough that every step, you could only step about a foot and a half. He pulled up your snowshoe out of the snow, slid your foot forward, stepped down, and kept doing that till you got here. But he got here with the turkeys, and they had their turkeys, and they dressed up his feet. They were in pretty bad shape. And I can still remember, about 3 days later, Dad coming home, and I can see my mother in the kitchen taking off the bandages such as they were and the socks which hadn't been off. And rather unpleasant to say, but as he'd take the sock off, many instances, the skin came with it. But the turkeys were delivered. He'd kept his word. That's about all I can think of.